Namaste, Sarasvati Devi, Varhani Kasani, Jesus, and Mahi Pasta Chavis. Vande Ham Sri Guru Sri Ta Padakamala, Sri Guru Vaishnavam Sta, Sri Rupam Sagrajatam, Sahagana, Raghunatam, Vitam, Sami Sajivam, Sadvaitam, Sadvadutam, Padijana, Sahita, Krishna Chaitanya Devam, Sri Radha, Krishna Padam, Sahagana, Lalita, Sri Vishakam, Vitam Sta. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it is October 22nd, 2009, in Vienna, Slovenia. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 30, Description of Adverse Fruit of Activities, Text 19. Okay, let's look at the verse for a minute. What can you tell me about the Sanskrit? What's the first word?
Yamaduta.
The Yamaduta. How many? Do you know what owl, the ending owl, tells you how many? Whenever you have owl, it means there's two. In Sanskrit, there's singular, plural, and also dual. So there's another few languages that have dual case. But does Slovenian have dual case? You have dual case. Okay, this is a dual case. So, and a dut is what? What's a dut mean? Like Prabhupada went on the jala dutta. What's a dutta? There's Vishnu duttas, there's a jala dutta, there's a yama dutta. What's a dutta? A servant or a messenger. The boat was the water messenger. Then you have the embassy, that's where the dutas are, the messengers, the diplomats. So it starts out with two yamadutas. And what's Prapta? What's Prapta? What's Prapta mean? Your Prapti city.
To obtain.
To obtain. And Praptao, because there's two. Which is interesting, because with the Jamil, how many yamadutas were there? So here there's two. So Praptao, here Prabhupada's saying arrived, but also mean to take. What about Bhima? What does the word Bhima mean? And here we have Bhima owl because there's two of them. What does Bhima mean? You know, the Pandava Bhima, when he was a little baby.
Horrible.
Horrible, terrible. Yes, something terrible. And we have Sarabhasha Ikshanel. Owl again, because there's two. What's Ikshana?
To see.
To see, good eyes. Very nice. Okay. And then Saha is what? Sa, Drista. What's Drista mean? We write it in here. That for Darshina, same word.
To see.
So Saha Drista. The person is seeing. What is he seeing? He's seeing these two yamadutas, right? Who are terrible. They have scary eyes. And then we have Hridaya. What's Hridaya mean?
Heart.
Okay. Anybody know what Sakrit and Mutram is? Anybody know what Mutram is? Sometimes we say a bad son, instead of being Putra, he's Mutra. Urine and sacred is stool. So what do you think this is saying? He's passing stool and urine, the man seeing these yamadutas. Okay. Yamaduta tada praptao. Bhimasara bhakeshanao. Sadrisva trusta hridaya. Sakrin mutram vimunchati. Please turn.
Yamaduta tada prapto.
Yamaduta tada prapto.
Vimasara prasikshana.
Vimasara prasikshana.
Sadrisva trasta
hridaya. Sadrisva trasta hridaya.
Sakrin mutram vimunchati.
Sakrin mutram vimunchati. Yamaduta tada prapto.
Yamaduta tada prapto.
Bhimasara. sarabha sekshana.
Bhima sarabha sekshana.
Sadrishtva trashta vidhaya.
Sadrishtva trashta vidhaya.
Sakrim mutram vimunchati.
Sakrim mutram vimunchati.
Yamadutam adapratam.
Yamadutam adapratam.
Bhima sarabha sekshana.
Bhima sarabha sekshana.
Sadrishtvatrastahritjaya Sakrimotravimunchati
Sakrimotravimunchati.
Ladies?
Yamadutavatatapratav
Bhimasarabhasekshanav Sarvasarastaridaya Sakrim mutram vimunchati
Yamaduta adaptav
Bhimasarabha sekshanav Sarvasarastaridaya Sakrim mutram vimunchati
Yamadutau, two messengers of Yamaraja. Tada, at that time, Praptau arrived. Bhimau, terrible. Sarabhasya, full of wrath. Ikshanau, their eyes. Saha, he, Jistva, seeing, Trasta, frightened, Riddayaha, his heart, Shakrit, stool, Mutram, urine, Vimunchati, he passes. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. At death he sees the messengers of the Lord of Death come before him, their eyes full of wrath, and in great fear he passes stool and urine. Purport. There are two kinds of transmigration of a living entity after passing away from the present body. One kind of transmigration is to go to the controller of sinful activities, who is known as Yamaraja, and the other is to go to the higher planets up to Vaikuntha Loka. Here, Lord Kapiladeva describes how a person engaged in activities of sense gratification to maintain a family are treated by the messengers of Yamaraja called Yamadutas. At the time of death, the Yamadutas become the custodians of those persons who have strongly gratified their senses. They take charge of the dying man and take him to the planet where Yamaraja resides. The conditions there are described in the following verses. Yamaduta tadao praptao bhima sara bhakshekshanao sadhristva trastaridaya sakrin mutram vimunchati. At death, he sees the messengers of the Lord of Death come before him, their eyes full of wrath, and in great fear he passes stool and urine. So we were mentioning the other day how that even most religious systems are teaching that you should just be a good family person, right? This is, I mean, the modern time, people are not even doing that. They're not even being responsible in family life. So if you know, most Christians, Hindus, Muslims, Jews, what are they teaching their followers, Buddhists, Jains? Be responsible in the world, take care of your family, you know, earn an honest livelihood, and do some prayer to God, you know, have some official religion. And so people in general are thinking that if they live like that, their lives are very pious and they're good and they don't need to worry about anything. Like, let's say sometimes you're doing something, you're engaged in some activity, and you think you're doing something that's very nice and that's very pleasing, and everybody will be happy with you. And then somehow or other, when you're done, everybody's angry with you. Does that ever happen? You know, you do something, maybe you work for hours or even days or weeks on something, and then when you're finished, people just get angry. Why did you do that? Why did you do it like that? It's not supposed to be done like that. And they're just angry at you. Does this ever happen to you?
So this is a surprise that a person gets because he's thinking, I'm leading a good life. I'm responsible, taking care of my family members, living nicely in the world. This is not describing somebody like Ajamyo, who left his, the care of his elderly parents, who left his wife, who was living with a prostitute, who was stealing and cheating and gambling. This is describing an ordinary person. But as Prabhupada says here, who strongly gratified their senses. So surprise, surprise. They thought they were doing everything nice, and at the end, then they get to see these really scary people. And they're really scary. Of course, nowadays there are people who try to look like these Yamadutas. You ever seen them? It's as if they took the paintings from the Bhagavatam of the Yamadutas and then they, they put on the makeup and the hair and the clothes. It really looks like Yamadutas walking around and they like to scare people. Now here Prabhupada's saying that there are different destinations. Now Krishna says everyone follows my path in all respects, but a path goes in two ways. A path doesn't only go in one way. So you can be going either closer to Krishna or further away from Krishna. And the results will be very different. One path, Prabhupada says here, is leading to lower planets, to punishment, to birth in the animal species. And the other path is leading to the heavenly planets or even all the way up to Vaikuntha. So it seems like it would be a really good idea to know in advance what behaviors are going to lead where, right? Wouldn't that be kind of smart to know that? And not just to do something. I used to live at the Hillsboro Temple, and Veer Krishna Swami used to talk about how he really liked yellow. So one of his disciples had the brilliant idea that he would paint everything yellow. And one time when Maharaj was out of town, I think he did it mostly at night, he got thought he was going to do a nice surprise. He got a big spray thing of paint, and he painted the outside of all the buildings bright, bright, bright yellow. And so you should ask. I find this also, I'm sure we all have this experience. People sometimes give me a gift. Like someone just gave me in Hungary a gift of a glass jar of oil. And I'm thinking, I'm always traveling on airplanes. What will I do with a glass jar of oil? How can I possibly bring that on the airplane? But they don't ask me. I was pleased with the thought. But they don't ask me, Urmila, what would you need? What would be helpful for you? So if we want to know what's going to be the proper path, we have to consult with the scriptures. We can't just go by some idea, like Prabhupada says a couple purports later, how a lot of the sinful activity in the world is going on by birth control. But most people think that birth control is something good. Okay? We just had this seminar on ecology in Hungary, and the first person to present was a very famous professor in Hungary. And he's not at all a devotee. But because he has some prestige, it added to the prestige of the conference, and that way you could bring people to come so they could also hear from the devotees. So he gave the first talk, and most of it was quite interesting. But he was really talking about overpopulation. And that was one of his main points, There's too many people. There's too many people. We can't have enough sense gratification because there's too many people. Just see the mentality, It's just like if you come and see the feast and you think, sometimes this happens when you're serving the prasadam. When you're serving the prasadam, you're looking at the line and thinking, I wonder if there'll be anything left for me after I serve it all out. So sometimes the servers wish that fewer people came to the festival. Actually, the cure for that is you make a place for the servers first. You have the servers make up their own plate and put it aside. Otherwise, sometimes what happens, especially if it's a fast day like Janmashtami, when people are really hungry, they'll sometimes be stingy. They'll be miserly with serving out the prasadam. So this is the mentality of the modern sense enjoyers, that everybody wants to be greedy for the resources of the earth, and therefore they want as few children born as possible. Right? They want there to be as few people as possible
competing for the world's resources. That's their mentality. Greed. Greed means that I want something at your expense. I want more than my quota. But they're promoting this as something positive. They're saying, you know, if we use birth control and abortion, then the world will be a better place. There won't be any hunger, and there won't be any unwanted children. Don't they say like this? Right? Then there'll be enough resources for everybody. You've all heard this propaganda, right? That it's socially responsible to only have 2 or 3 children. If you have more than that, you're socially irresponsible. And now, especially in Europe, the birth rate has gone down so low, especially in a country like Italy, where you have so many more older people than younger people. You have nobody to create wealth in the society anymore. And there's a great concern now that so few children are being born, how society will go on. But it's very interesting, just like we're saying that this man, he's thinking, you know, I'm very responsible, and he's getting the opposite result. He's getting the Yamadutas come for him. He's not going to heaven. You know, so in the same way, they're propounding this idea of birth control. If we use birth control and abortion, then all children will be loved and wanted. You know, all children will get a good upbringing. There'll be fewer people on the planet. So the ecology will be very good, and there'll be enough food to go around, and everybody will be happy. Now, since the propounding of birth control and abortion, which started really seriously in about the 1970s, maybe 60s or 70s, like in the 1970s in America, only 4% of children were born out of marriage, and now it's 40%. And a lot of those children are born intentionally out of marriage, because now people are waiting so long to get married. The women get to be 40 years old, they're still not married, they have no child, so they have a child without marriage, intentionally. And hunger in the world is not going away. There are still just as many starving people in the world, and the pollution of the earth is getting worse. So they're thinking that this is going to be something pious to solve the problem, but it has the opposite effect. So also a person thinks, yes, I'm a very pious person working hard to maintain my family, but the effect is the opposite. So one must know from the Shastra what will have the right effect. And this is just common sense. If you buy some machine, then you have to read the instruction manual to find out what will have what effect. You're just guessing, oh, I think this will work, or I think that'll work. Why is it that there is such a severe reaction? We're going to read about the terrible reaction this poor man undergoes, and probably that all of us have undergone at least once. And why is there such a terrible reaction just for being a good family person who is responsibly maintaining your family, who cares about maintaining your family, probably even doing some good work in the world? Are you lost?
Yes.
Okay. We might ask, I'll go back, I'll rewind, why is there such a terrible reaction, which all of us have probably experienced at least once, just for being a responsible family person? Who's earning an honest livelihood, who cares about his family, and probably wants to do good in the world. Why is there such a terrible reaction for this? So the key here is in the word strongly. Prabhupada's talking about strongly gratifying their senses. We are allowed to satisfy our senses in this world. In fact, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says you can't live without senses. Without satisfying your senses, you have to eat, breathe, and so forth. But it is in the method of satisfying your senses. You know, what happens is people are born in this world, they have senses, the senses are demanding satisfaction, and they see all around them the sense objects. And so naturally they think, well, here I am, I don't know who I am, I don't know how I got here, I have these desires, and around me are all of the means of fulfilling my desires. All right, I guess I can just take them and use them. But an intelligent person asks, who am I? What is the purpose of my senses? And to whom does all these things belong? Right? That's an intelligent person. I read about one man, a wealthy man, who was looking for a secretary.
And so he set up, you understand, secretary? Okay. He set up a room with all sorts of tricks. We would call them booby traps. I don't know if you know what that word means. Anyway, he had a bowl of cherries, looked like cherries, but inside each cherry there was chili powder. And then he had a drawer with a lock, and the key was in the lock. But inside the drawer were all these springs that would jump out, you know, that you'd have difficulty putting back in. And he had all these, like, tricks in the room. And when people came to apply for the job of being the secretary, he'd say, I'll be with you in a minute, can you just wait in this room? And then he wanted to see if they would meddle, if they would touch the things in the room. It was very obvious if they had. And he finally hired the one person who did not meddle. So we find ourselves in this world, surrounded by the objects of our desire, but it is our duty to ask, to whom does everything belong? Why am I here? What is my purpose? And the answers are there in the Shastra. Now, even among these religions who are saying, just be a responsible family person, that's not the instruction of their Shastra. Jesus Christ was not teaching that the perfection of life is to have a happy family and to work hard in the world. That wasn't his teaching. That's not the teaching of Muhammad. That's not the teaching of Abraham and Moses. That's not the teaching of Buddha. It's certainly not the teaching of the Vedas. So the teachings of the Shastra are, yes, you can satisfy your senses, but through jagya. Through sacrifice. Otherwise, you are stealing. Right? You're stealing. It's not like I can just come in this room and I see there's a vase of flowers and I say, I like flowers. I think I'll take it to my room. I think I'll take it with me. No, I have to ask. I didn't build this place. I'm not paying for this place. I have to ask. Can I have it? And they may say, yes, there's a price. Or just like you have a little shop here. You can't just go there and say, I really like the japa mala. You have this big japa mala, you know, 2 meters high. Oh, I always wanted a japa mala 2 meters high. I think I'll take this to my, take it with me. You have to pay. You have to pay. And if you don't pay, then you're punished. And also the nature of this world is that our sense gratification is almost always at the cost of some other living entity. And when we're eating, somebody is harmed, generally speaking. One living entity is food for another. Practically everything we get, you know, we get this wool, we have to take the wool off the sheep. We're taking something. Therefore, there is some reaction if I don't do it in sacrifice. So this is not unreasonable. To the materially engrossed person, it seems unreasonable. Why should I have to suffer simply for fulfilling my natural desires with the objects that are around me? Because the objects that are around you do not belong to you. And in fact, your own body doesn't belong to you. Your own senses do not belong to you. And the purpose of your senses is different. The purpose of your senses is to glorify Krishna, not simply to be satisfied on your own. So the real process for how to, if you want to be satisfied even in this world, there is a process. I was just reading today in the Krishna book, in the description of autumn, where Prabhupada said, for the materialistic person, everything seems, he used the word, aggressive. And for the spiritualist, everything seems happy. And all the conditions of life appear happy. So a materialistic person sees everything as aggressive. They see everything as competing. Like this ecology professor, we're all competing for the world's resources. They see everyone as basically an enemy. You know, if you cooperate with me, then you're my friend. But they see that we're all in competition.
We're competing for space, we're competing for food, we're competing for money, we're competing for air. And when I look at each situation, each living entity, is this going to help me with my sense gratification, or is this going to hurt me with my sense gratification? And even my friends, I'm always careful. Maybe my friend will become an enemy, because they don't. You marry somebody, and later they divorce you and write some book about you, make a lot of money, tell me about all your problems to the world. You know that people do this? So your friend can become instantly an enemy. So they see the world as a very antagonistic place, very competitive. And what they're getting for their sense gratification, they're trying to do it by trickery or by not exactly fair negotiation or by exploitation. Whereas the devotee who's living in, as jagya, they see everything as happy, even in this world. Religion is not saying be miserable in this world. My dear friends, if you're miserable, then there's something wrong with your spiritual life. Seriously, if you see the world as a very aggressive place, if you see this world as some sort of a battle with aggressors and enemies, and that means we're in materialistic consciousness. Spiritual consciousness, I see even this world, it's a very happy place. Everything is exactly as it's supposed to be. And one feels happy in all circumstances. If you pay the proper price for something, then you have the right to enjoy it. Right? And one who does that will go to heaven. What to speak of if somebody is enjoying all the gifts of the Lord as prasadam, well, then they go to Vaikuntha. So one should be at least going up. One should be at least going up. At least one should be paying the proper sacrifice for whatever one is enjoying in this world. That's the bottom level of going up. That's the first step in the positive direction. Pay the sacrifice. Even if you want to enjoy the fruits of your work, even if you want to be a materialist, pay the proper sacrifice. Higher than that is you're dedicating your work to Krishna. Higher than that is you're working for a relationship with Krishna. Higher than that, you're just thinking about Krishna's happiness. And the only thing you're trying to enjoy is Krishna's happiness. And your pleasure is that Krishna is happy. So this verse reminds me of a story that I read, a true story. What's his name? Howard Storm is his name. So Howard Storm was an art professor. Did I lose you again?
Yes.
Okay. This verse and purport reminds me of a story about a man named Howard Storm. That's just a true story. And you can even buy his book. It's called My Descent into Death.
What does it mean, descent?
Going down. So he was a professor of art in a university. And he was an atheist. And he was not just an atheist, but he was a preaching atheist. He was a very enthusiastic atheist. So he would tell the students in his class, don't do any religious pictures in my class. If you do a religious picture, I will give you you will fail. I will not let you pass the class. So he's going on like this in his life. And one day, he was in America. One day he and his wife came to France for a convention of art professors. And while he was there, he got very sick. He was taken to the hospital. And somehow in the hospital, he was neglected. He was just like left alone in the room. And I don't remember exactly what was wrong with him. Anyway, he died. At first he didn't realize he was dead. He's just in the room, he's in very much pain. All of a sudden, he sees some doctors and nurses in the doorway telling him to come. So he didn't realize he was dead at first, and he just starts following them. And as he's following them and following them, their forms start to change, and they start to manifest these very frightening forms. And he starts to realize, I don't know where I am anymore. I don't think I'm in the hospital. I don't know where they've taken me. He tries to get back and he can't get back. And after a little while he realizes, I'm dead. My body must be dead in the hospital. And these beings start tormenting him and teasing him. You understand teasing? They start calling him names and things and laughing at him. And he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know how to go back. And so he continues to follow him, to follow them. At a certain point, he decides that these are evil beings and he's not going to follow them anymore. So he stops. When he stops, they jump on him and they start tearing apart his body. They also start sexually molesting him. And they're all laughing at him and calling him names, and he's suffering terrible pain. Because pain is not really happening in the gross body. All pain is happening in the mind. The proof of this is if you give somebody an anesthetic, they will not feel pain. Also, it is possible, Prabhupada says, and I've had personal experience of this, if you detach your mind properly, you don't feel any bodily pain. So pain is happening in your mind. So he was feeling terrible pain. Then while he's lying there, some thought came to him, and it wasn't his own thought, but a thought came to him, pray. And he's thinking, pray? Pray to whom? I don't believe in God. There's no God. How can I pray? And again, pray. Okay, well, I have nothing to lose. So, but I don't know how to pray. I've never said any prayers. So he starts thinking of songs that have the word God in them that he learned when he was a little child. Like, God bless America. And he starts singing these songs. And as soon as he starts singing like that, these beings become very angry. They say, stop that, stop that. But they start moving away. So he thinks, oh, this is a good idea. So he tries to think of anything that has the word God in it or Lord, and he's just singing. And gradually these beings all go away. They're back. They become frightened and they move away, but they're still yelling at him. Stop this! Nobody will save you! Why are you calling on God? You know, and they go away. And then he's again alone. Then some celestial, some higher being comes and heals him. And then takes him to a higher realm, and he sees a light. He understands this is God. But he says, I can't go close. I'm too fallen. I can't go in the presence of God. So he's given many instructions. He's taught about karma and reincarnation and different things like that. And then he's returned to his body. When he's returned to his body is still broken, and it takes a long time for him to get better. But he completely changes his life. He gives up his profession as an art teacher. He becomes a minister. And he travels preaching. He explained that after this incident, that he was explained that many times whenever he would pray, he would have strange symptoms, like his hairs would stand on end and his voice was shaking, you know, sometimes he'd fall to the ground and be stunned, and it was very embarrassing for him and his wife. They didn't quite know what to do about this. And he says how often when he'd go into a church, if he hears people singing, that he'll also see celestial beings in the ceiling of the church and hear them singing along with the people in the church. So one time in one of his lectures he was giving as a minister, speaking about his experiences. So one nun came up to him after the lecture and she said, I can't believe it took such a long time. He says, what are you talking about? She said, I used to be one of your students in the university 13 years before you had your disease. And when you said that none of us were allowed to do religious pictures, I went back to the convent and I told all the sisters to pray for you. So for 13 years, all of us were praying for you every day. And she said, I'm sure because of that, you got the impression that you should pray. You got some instruction like that you should pray. But anyway, people are experiencing this. that Yamaraj has taken them. I've even talked to some devotees who, before they joined the Krishna consciousness movement, had some near-death experiences where they saw the Yamadutas. I've talked to at least two different devotees who had this experience. So this is very real. Therefore, we should always be going upward. Krishna says even a little advancement on this path will protect one from the most dangerous kind of fear. So the most dangerous kind of fear is that we'll fall back to the animal species, or that we'll have to be punished like this. And Yamaraj tells his servants, of course, in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, that if someone has one time with sincerity offered obeisances to the Lord, one time chanted the holy name, don't bother such persons. But we should always be moving up. You know, this fall down to degraded activities can happen even to devotees. We've seen it. It's usually very gradual. You know, oh, I don't have to follow Ekadasi so strictly, or I don't have to chant all of my rounds, or I can eat some onions and garlic, or I can watch. So usually it's a start with something small. And after a while, one becomes very degraded. So we should be very careful that we're moving up. The tendency of the living entity is dynamic. It's very difficult for us to just stay in one place. We tend to be moving either away from Krishna or toward Krishna. So be careful not to move in the wrong direction. Prabhupada says here there's two paths, two kinds of transmigration. Be careful not to move away. Yes, it's a fact that once you start taking up Krishna consciousness, like Yamaraj said, one time you offer obeisances, the Yamadutas won't come after you. But we shouldn't sin on the strength of chanting. We shouldn't say, well, yes, I'm a devotee, so I don't have to worry about Yamaraj. I've done so much devotional service. That's true. But still, we find Bharat became a deer. Happens. It sometimes happens. Gajendra became an elephant. There may be some circumstances. We read about how those who commit offenses in Vrindavan can become animals in Vrindavan. It is certainly possible to be degraded. So we should always be moving up. How am I progressing? How am I progressing? What am I doing today? What am I doing now to progress? How am I increasing my Krishna consciousness? How am I getting closer to Krishna? Which way am I moving on the path? This is what we should be asking ourselves. Never being satisfied, just, okay, yes, everything's all right. Everything's all right. Find a way always to increase the quality, to increase maybe the quantity, to increase both, and whatever we're doing, our chanting, our dealing with devotees, our reading the Prabhupada's books, and to go upward on the path, and not just to satisfy ourselves, oh yes, yes, I am a very nice person. I am a very nice person. We see this man who's being taken by the Yamadutas. He also thought he was a very nice person. He didn't think he was an evil person. So always be moving up, and always make sure that what we're doing is in accord with the Shastras. Don't be fooled. Please don't be fooled by the propaganda of modern society. You know, modern society, they're saying what's good and bad, but they have no basis in Shastra. Just like they're saying, and I know I'm sort of stealing the class from, what's today? Today's Thursday. I'm kind of stealing whoever's going to give class on Saturday when Prabhupada talks about birth control. But just like they're making this propaganda that birth control is going to be good. It will be good for the women. It will be good for the society. It will be good for the planet. And they're wrong. Even materially, they're wrong. It's not good for anybody. The earth would be much better, people would be much better off if everybody was having six children than if people are using this artificial birth control. They don't know what's right and what's wrong. They don't know what's better, what's higher. They think they're doing something wonderful, and in the end they will find out that's not the case. Just like now, you know, gradually all over the world they're saying, ask. A homosexual should get married and they should have the same benefits in society as anyone else who's married. We've been so cruel to homosexuals all these years. And now we should rectify this and give them the same position in society. And they're saying this will help people. It will help homosexuals. It will help everybody. It will benefit society. But they're not following Shastra. They're not following Shastra. And therefore the result that they achieve will be the opposite. Another example is divorce. And when I was a little girl, practically nobody got divorced. It was very unusual. Divorce was just, you know, if someone is beating their wife or something. Generally, people didn't divorce. I knew one person who was divorced. And now, half. So they're thinking, this is a very good thing if we make a more liberal divorce law. People will be happier. They even said the children would be happier. They said children will be happier to be with one parent than to be with two parents who are fighting. Right? This was the propaganda. But it hasn't been the case. So many studies how children from divorced families have so many more problems. Study after study after study shows the same thing. What to speak of the adults, how unhappy they are. How much discord it causes. I was just hearing Prabhupada say this to men this morning. How, you know, as soon as there's divorce, everything becomes disturbed. And we could give so many examples. Or when, you know, when my sisters were little, this idea that science and technology was going to save the world. Everybody was going to be happy by having a refrigerator and a car and taking antibiotics. Antibiotics was supposed to be the greatest thing ever for the planet, right? And now they're finding it causes super infections and so many other problems. So if we want to know what will really bring happiness, we have to go to the Shastra. We can't just speculate, oh, it looks to me like this thing will bring happiness. We don't know. Then we may be surprised at the time of death or even in this life. Why is it that I thought I was doing the right thing, but the result that I got, as Prahlad Maharaj says, the result one gets is the opposite of what I wanted. I wanted something, and I got the opposite. I wanted a happy society through technology, I got pollution and disease. I wanted all children who were born to be loved and wanted, and we got a 10 times increase in unwanted children. So the man is thinking, I'm a good person, I'm a pious person, and the Yamaduttas don't agree. They say, I'm very sorry, sir, you're actually a thief. You're actually a criminal. And I thought I was a good person. No, you're a criminal. Okay. So thank you. Questions, comments? Yes, please.
One danger when one can say, I don't believe Shastra, I don't believe scripture, because common men, they dare to write, like many Christians, they say they go in Jerusalem, they write their own Bible, and they propose to the faithful people. So they accept, but I don't accept because they are men, which are translated, this scripture. Another extreme is that I know the Shastra very well because I know the secret, the language very good, I know any detail of the grammatica. And the danger is opposite, that I know very well.
Mm.
No? Or the opposite is I don't believe because it's something, but we know that at least in the Vedic case, the Vedas are self-born.
Yes, the Vedas are coming from the breathing of the Lord. So you're saying that we have two problems about following Shastra. One is people who say, we don't accept the Shastra as authority because it's been changed or because it's the work of ordinary people, right? And then you have people who say, yes, we follow the Shastra, but I'm going to explain the real meaning of the Shastra. The real meaning of the Shastra is that, you know, it's fine to drill for oil and abortion is fine and all these, you know, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. So therefore we have Guru Sadhu Shastra. Just like even in the modern democratic governments, they have three branches of government: the judicial, the executive, and the legislative. You all remember this from school?
Okay.
And in the Vedic idea, the legislative is the what? What's the legislative branch? It's a shastra. And who's the judicial branch? Judicial branch decides, what do the shastras mean? How do you apply them? Who's the judicial branch? The brahmanas, the sadhus, guru. And then the executive, of course, the kshatriyas, that make sure that the shastra is followed under the guidance of the brahmanas. And you can have an imbalance. Just like the Roman Catholic Church, they had put, maybe they still do, they had put emphasis on sadhu and guru, and not on shastra. In the Middle Ages, most common people didn't read the shastra. They just heard all the instructions through the priests and the monks. And then Martin Luther did the opposite. He said, these people are cheating, throw them out. Everybody just study the shastra directly. Right? That became Protestant Christianity. Then everyone, of course, becomes their own guru. Everyone becomes their own sadhu. I will understand the meaning of the scriptures. You need all of these. And of course, Mahabharata says that you should follow the path of the Mahajanas if you want to know how to live and how to apply the shastras. The Mahabharata says that logic doesn't reach a firm conclusion. The sages argue with each other. The scripture may say different things in different places, so you follow the path of the Mahajanas. And who are the Mahajanas? Swayam Narada Sanghu, Komara Kapilomanu, Pralada Janako Bhishma, Bali and Vyasakir Vayam. How do they live? How do the great personalities live? From that way you can see what does the shastra mean? How is the shastra applied? I remember one professor was studying the movement. He was asking about women. And he said, how do we understand how women should be treated? What's more important, what it says in the shastra or what Prabhupada did? I said, we follow the Mahajanas. They understand how to apply the shastra. What does it mean? And so we can also look at history. How have people lived according to shastra? What kind of lives did they have? Do we have any record in the shastra of people having abortions? Do we have any record in the shastra of people using all this modern technology and exploiting the earth? Do we have record in the shastras of homosexuals getting married? I mean, is there any record like this in the shastras? Does it exist? We can understand them. How are they interpreting the shastra? Do we have any record in the shastra of divorce? No. So that's how you actually understand how the shastra are applied. How are the sadhus applying it? Of course, at some level, you have to have some faith, because you can say, well, how do I know that they're sadhus? And it becomes circular, because I know they're sadhus because they meet the descriptions of the shastra. The shastra is telling me, just like Arjuna asked Krishna, what are the symptoms of a saintly person? And Krishna says, these are the symptoms of a saintly person. So there is some level of faith. But how can you live without faith? If I don't have some faith, then I have faith in myself. Then I'm the one who's deciding what I think. Or I have faith in some material psychologist or scientist or something like that. Some empirical study. So a certain level, I have to have faith. I read the shastra. I have to have some faith that the shastra is bona fide. Okay? And I read the shastra. The shastra tells me what are the qualities of a saintly person. And you'll find some qualities of the saintly person that are described by all of the scriptures of the world. You don't have to just look at the Vedic scriptures. The Bible also says, what are the fruits of the Spirit? When Jesus said, you judge by your fruits, he says, what are the fruits of the Spirit? That's there. So then you look for people who have those qualities in the past, in history, and today. How do they live? How do they apply the shastra? How do they explain the shastra?
Does that, I think that's about the best we can do, yes?
In our case, our Shastra comes from Prabhupada, he has translated all the books, because we did not even know that they were existing.
That's true.
So it must be, it's like a supreme authority, Srila Prabhupada's books.
I mean, we have, certainly we don't have, Srila Prabhupada didn't give us necessarily detailed instructions about every single thing. It's not that we have exactly what to do in every single circumstance. But Prabhupada is certainly explaining the meaning of the Shastras and how to apply them. Again, I don't think we can say he's given us something that we can understand every single circumstance. Like devotees were asking some questions about Tulsi, and Prabhupada in the letter said, use some common sense, and if you don't have any, find somebody who does. So, there may be some details. Like I was running a Gurukul, and there's no instructions in the Shastra. How do you teach English spelling? What method of teaching English spelling is best? There's no instructions. Or right now I'm creating a book to teach reading English. Again, there's about three main methods of teaching English reading. Which one is the best? There's nothing in the Shastra. It doesn't say. Prabhupada doesn't say. So there's no. You have to use empiricism. So I'm designing the course so you can use it with any of the three methods. Because I know if I pick one method, some people will argue with me. Oh, that's not the best method. So try to arrange it for all of them. So there are some things like that that just they don't. Maybe they exist in some part of the Shastra we don't have. Because the Vedas covered all different branches of knowledge. But yeah, we have Prabhupada's instructions. And then Pratyekshavananam Dharma. Ultimately, it's not just faith, it's experience. We apply the instructions of the Shastra given by a great sadhu like Srila Prabhupada, and does it work? Do I start getting the benefits that are listed in Shastra? Like Prabhupada said, if you're eating, but you say, I'm not becoming satisfied, then either you're not really eating, or there's some parasites in your intestines. So if you say, I'm doing Krishna consciousness, but I'm not becoming free of material attachment, then either you're not actually doing Krishna consciousness, you're doing something else, or you're doing Krishna consciousness, but there are some offenses that are stealing away the benefit. And one should be experiencing. Maybe not experiencing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but one should be experiencing. One should be saying, these scriptures are wonderful. Prasadam is wonderful. Worshipping the deity is wonderful. You should be experiencing some joy that is not material joy, at least sometimes. That's our ultimate proof, is pratyeksha, our own direct experience. And that's what ultimately gives us faith in the scriptures. And then the things that I can't know. And I follow the scripture. Does that help? It's very difficult for a conditioned soul to want to have faith in the scripture, because just if you look at logic, again, I'll give this example of birth control, because it's such an easy example to understand. It's so logical, right? Isn't it logical? It looks like there's a limited amount of resources on the planet, right? Only so much land that you can use to grow food, only so much oil, only so much clean water. It looks like there's a limited amount, there's a finite amount, right? Okay. And then if you have, you can think, okay, well, if we want everyone to have a certain standard of living with the resources that exist, there can only be a certain number of people. Doesn't that sound logical? It sounds very logical. What's the problem with that logic? The problem with that logic is that Krishna has the capability of supplying more. That's the first problem with that logic. And the second problem with that logic is it depends how you're using the resources. I was thinking about this with water. So in a simple society,
Where are people bathing? In the river. Now, when you bathe in the river, is the water having to go through a sewage system? No. Are you taking any water? You're not taking any water. Nothing. Where are they doing laundry? In the river. Are they taking any water? Nothing. We're pulling water from the aquifers. You know the aquifers, the water under the ground? So for our bathing and our laundry, we're pulling water from the aquifers and then we're putting it through a sewage system. They weren't doing that. And then what about washing pots and plates? What did they do for them? No, they didn't. No. What kind of plates did they use? Invaded.
Leaves.
Do you have to wash them?
No.
Animals eat them. I remember when I first went to Jagannath Puri, and they gave us this prasada, you know, in these leaf containers. And when we were finished, I said, where do I throw them? They said, throw them on the street. I said, I'm not going to throw my garbage on the street. I'm an American. We don't throw our garbage on the street. But I had no choice because there was no other place to throw it. So I threw it on the street and some cow came like that and ate it. And what? So they're eating utensils they could just throw in the street. They didn't have to wash them. What about cooking? What were they using for cooking? Clay pots. And not fired clay pots, what they call half-baked. Because when you fire clay in a kiln, it becomes almost like glass, and it lasts for a very long time. But if you half-bake it, then if you just throw it on the ground, after a few rain, it becomes again earth. They didn't have to wash their pots. If you read about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu sitting on the pile of the used pots, they didn't wash their pots. Wouldn't that be nice, not to have to wash your pots? And people had a business making clay pots. They employed somebody making clay pots. So they're making them, and you get your clay pot cheap. You use it once, and then you throw it away. So you can have a lot of people on the earth if you're using water like that. Now, can't you? How much water were they actually using? Cooking and drinking. Right? Bathing they weren't using, laundry they weren't using, washing pots and dishes they weren't using. So I guess, you know, cleaning your house, your water usage actually, that you're making the water dirty, is cleaning your house, drinking, and cooking. That's it. And then they didn't use a sewage system. When people had to pass, they had a place in the ground, so it didn't pollute the water. And that way you can have a large number of people living for thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years without worrying about running out of water. That makes sense? So one of the reasons that they think there's too many people is they don't know how to use the resources. They're using the resources in an improper way. And another reason, they don't realize that the earth can withhold or make available, and that Krishna can also make available unlimited resources. But they don't understand this with their logic. So they're saying we must cut down the population. And then how are you going to cut down the population? So they're saying, okay, you can't stop sex. So we'll use some artificial means so people can have sex and not have children. And this also sounds very logical, doesn't it? Doesn't that sound logical? Sounds very reasonable. Right? Who would argue with the logic? Don't try to get people to stop sex. That's very difficult. Probably impossible. So, okay, you give them some chemical or some device so they can still have sex, but they won't have children. And then we won't have so many people. Not only will we not have so many people, but also, there's always a problem with children that are neglected or not cared for, right? And this way that won't happen, because if people don't want children, they don't have to have children. It's very reasonable. And of course, sometimes birth control doesn't work, so then we'll kill the child in the womb, and
by logic, you would think that this would mean every single child on the planet would be loved and wanted. Doesn't that make sense from a logical point of view? So why didn't it work? This was started in the 1970s. So we would say certainly by the 1980s or the 1990s, we should have completely stopped all births of children out of marriage. Right? There should be zero birth out of marriage in the world today. Why? Or the opposite has happened. Why? Because as soon as you make birth control and abortion available, then people don't get married anymore. They think, why should I marry? It's one of the main reasons people marry. They marry so they can have a legitimate way to have sex. If you make it available without children, then why should I marry? And now people, you know, they're not marrying at all. I've read that now maybe only 40% of people in places like Sweden even ever marry at all. Why get married? And if I want to marry, I'll marry when I'm 30, 35, after I've already had, you know, 15 boyfriends, girlfriends. And people get a mentality of separating sex and children. That becomes their mentality. Therefore, they lose the whole element of jagya. They lose the whole idea of sacrifice. And that's then it brings in the whole idea that homosexuality is legitimate. If birth control and abortion are not legitimate, if people understand that sex means children, then they will never say that homosexuality is proper. Nobody will say. But because they're allowing this for men and women, then they allow for homosexuals. So this is, it all seems very logical. It seems very reasonable. And they don't think in organizational theory, if you study about policies, they call this the law of unintended consequences. You get a result that you didn't want to get. So what's happened is people have separated sex from having children, and now marriage has become, as Prabhupada says, an imagination. And the result is that so many children are now born out of marriage, and there's more unwanted children, and there's more unloved children than there were before birth control. 10 times more. So if we don't follow the Shastra, then what are we following? I'm following my logic. I'm following what just appears to me to be something that makes sense. But it may not make sense. It may be the opposite. I don't know how the machine of this universe works. My knowledge is limited. So I'm on very dangerous ground if I don't follow Shastra and the Sadhus. I don't know what the result will be. Prabhupada said, don't experiment with truth. I don't know what I. Again, like this man, he didn't think the Yamadutas were going to come for him. Did he think that? No. His whole life, this man in the Bhagavatam, did he think the Yamadutas were going to take him? No. He never thought like that. It didn't one time come into his mind, the Yamadutas will come for him. Then I become the authority. With my own logic and reason, what will work, what will not work. Yes?
Yesterday, I seen this video of Srila Prabhupada's time when devotees were living in this nice atmosphere. Everybody was engaged in service, child were happy. It looked like another world, but it is real, no? But and also you mentioned your father. At the end, he accepted the personality of Prabhupada because he understood that this man is powerful in something special. Then he also surrendered, not to some extent. But we can see now it's very difficult because we are led by Prabhupada, disciple, and not so many times. Not often they are in accord with themselves, they are different opinions. way of leading, and sometimes also we hear this. We disagree among us, but we are friends. Like some phrase like this. But for us, that our only hope is that the instruction and the teaching of Prabhupada would continue to rule this movement. When we see this statement, we become afraid, because what will happen when all the Prabhupada disciples will disappear and we have to do the job by ourselves?
So if you see that things are disordered, like we were reading yesterday, if you see that things are disordered, because after the Acharya leaves, things will become disordered. Guaranteed. So you become Acharya. That's the challenge. You become Charya. Charya means realization. If you really want to understand the Shastra, you have to have realization. You have to have a higher level of consciousness. You can't understand any other way. You can't understand just by logic. Logic is useful. Scholarship is useful. We're not saying those are bad things. We're not saying you shouldn't use logic or you shouldn't have scholarship. We're not saying that. But that's not enough. In logic, we call it necessary but not sufficient. You know, flour and butter and sugar are necessary for a cake, but they're not sufficient. You have to have a liquid. So scholarship is fine, logic is fine. You have to have realization. So you become an acharya. Prabhupada wanted all of us to become acharyas. And if otherwise, then you can just go to God. Like Advaita Acharya did. Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur did. Help! Come! Send somebody! Things are disordered. And come has to happen pretty frequently. It's just like, how often do you have to clean your room? You have to do it pretty often. Right? You can't go like every 2 months cleaning your room. Isn't it? Even if you're just one person and you don't make a big mess, at least 2 weeks you have to clean. Generally, 1 week at least you have to clean. So also in this world, Dharma becomes disordered very fast. If you look at the history of religion, you see there's some Acharya comes and preaches, and very, very soon it becomes distorted. Very, very, very quickly. Then again, it has to be reestablished. Again. That's the way it is. In this world, you can't do something and you do it and it stays.
But then a child must be Nitya Siddha. I cannot.
Why?
Because nobody, right. Even in our movement.
Narada Muni was not Nitya Siddha. Narada Muni was Sadhana Siddha. Dhruva was Sadhana Siddha. Why Nitya Siddha?
I say I'm the Acharya, nobody will trust me because I'm a conditioned soul. At least in the very first part of my life, I was not even a religious.
Look, you know what? Not everybody's going to trust you no matter what. It's not that everybody trusts Jesus. It's not that everyone in the world trusts Srila Prabhupada. How many people in the world trust Srila Prabhupada? You know, we're talking about how many people? Are we talking about a million? Maybe, I mean, just a wild guess, maybe there's a million people in the world who consider Prabhupada an authority. There's 6 billion people on the planet. Not everybody accepts Krishna as an authority. How many people accept God as an authority, even if you want to expand to God? How many people accept God as an authority? On spiritual matters, I want to speak about material matters. That's always the case. There's one devotee in the movement who has a PhD in astrophysics. I don't think there's very many devotees in our movement who have a degree in astrophysics. And she was on the committee working for the planetarium. But she finally left because she said nobody would ever pay any attention to her. Not only does she have a degree in astrophysics, but she is she's very knowledgeable in Sanskrit, and she's done a thorough study not only of the sections of the Bhagavatam about astronomy, but also any Vedic literature that deals with the position of the planets in astronomy. She's probably the most qualified person that we have on the planet. And she said nobody listened to her. She said probably it's because I'm a woman, and she's only like 30-something now. I did a very funny thing. I started saying, well, why don't we take what would be the ideal material conditions for people to listen to you? And halfway into my writing this, I realized I was talking about a specific person. But I didn't think that when I started. I said, well, let's see. The perfect authority, they'd be a man, Indian, born in a Vaishnava family, raised as a Vaishnava, always having perfectly followed the Vaishnava principles, a perfect gentleman, a disciple of Srila Prabhupada, someone who always followed their vows, someone who was also trained in science and had it, and all of a sudden I goes, oof, I'm talking about Bhakti Swamidana Maharaj. And I said, how many people accepted him as an authority? Very few. Even there was a split in the Bhaktivedanta Institute and at least four different groups. So you'll never be in a position where everybody will accept you, even if you're a self-realized soul. Who's self-effulgent. Look at Jesus. People tried to kill him. Some of his own people tried to kill him. Prabhupada's godbrothers, most of them didn't accept him. Most of them criticized him. That's the way. I'm at Krishna. Krishna comes to the planet. He's walking around the planet. And Kaliyavana sees him and says, wow, he's Vasudeva. Powerful, let me kill him. Now Krishna goes to Duryodhan to make peace. And Duryodhan says, I'm not going to listen to you. And Krishna says, look, don't give back Indraprastha. Just give five villages, one for each Pandava, five little villages. And Duryodhan says, I'm not going to give enough land to stick a pin into. I'm not going to give anything. And Krishna shows his universal form. You think that would convince him? Didn't convince him. He said, oh, Krishna's got some magic. You know, some mystic power. Arrest him, he said. So people don't listen to Krishna. Krishna's giving instruction on spiritual matter and people don't pay attention to him. How many people are listening to him? So that's not the criteria. How many people are listening? Become an acharya. It doesn't matter how many people are listening. That's not the point. And if you can't do that, then you ask Krishna to send somebody. System, if you see that there's no one. First of all, I'm not convinced right now that there's no one. I think we do have people on this planet who are associated with our Hare Krishna movement who are actually very realized persons. So I don't think there's a lack. But if you think there's a lack, ask Krishna to send. It's about Vinanta Guru. He said, please send me one of your associates. And Advaita Acharya said, you better come yourself. And that has to keep happening. That has to keep happening over and over and over again. Please don't think you're just going to stay. You have to keep putting life into it. You have to keep having people who are bringing life. And it's not necessary that all great personalities have to agree on every point. You know, we have many times in Prabhupada's purport, she talks about disagreements among the acharyas. There can be disagreements and still friends, but you don't disagree about the basic principles. And then you can say, well, how do you know? The Burjan Prabhu has a problem with this. How do you know what's the basic principle that can't be changed and what's the detail that can be changed? And Prabhu said that requires intelligence. So it requires some realization. A lot of the disagreements that go on in ISKCON right now, if you really boil it down to the essence, is what is a principle and what is a detail. If you think something's a detail and I think it's a principle, then you'll think it can be adjusted and I'll think it can't be adjusted. And a lot of our conflict, if you really get to the root, is on that. What is a principle and what is a detail? Expect things to degrade. Expect there to be splits. We've already had splits. We have. like we have the Ritvik, who are like a parallel ISKCON, right? They have their own temples. They have their own temples. They say they're following Prabhupada, but they're separate society. And then we have other splits, people who've gone to different Gaudiya gurus. That will happen. You can't stop that from happening. If you look at history, that's... You can talk about how we'll manage it, but you can't say that we'll stop it. So try to work with people who you understand actually are realized and following. You yourself become realized. And ask Krishna to protect religion. And Dharma is still very much alive and well in the in ISKCON, at least I think so. Somebody else may have a different opinion, but I think so. I've met many highly realized Vaishnavas. Some of them have titles and some of them don't. Some of them are just making garlands somewhere. Nobody knows their name. Some of them are good preachers. And I see that their people can become, they can achieve the goal of life in ISKCON. That's what I'm seeing. Does that help you? That's the best I can do. All right, it has become very late. That was my plan was to end. Oh, why it doesn't work? My plan was to end early. Does anybody else have anything on this? On our two young Dudas? The poor guy passing stool and urine. Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right, we should go.